This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. With 25 Town of Normal jobs cut, incoming city manager Pam Reese says she's aware of potential burnout for those remaining workers.
It's going to have to be something that we are cautious, that we are keeping track of. There may be things that we can't continue to do.
GLT's Ryan Denham also talks with Reese about Uptown Normal and job creation. Most of us listen to music thanks to internet streaming providers, but Bloomington Normal's three record stores are still doing fine. Hear from the three entrepreneurs who sell analog music in the digital age. And during an edition of Grow, find out how the Central Illinois wind can be a friend and not just a foe. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's February 9th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A big transition is underway in Normal as retiring city manager Mark Peterson turns things over to his top deputy and now successor, Pam Reese. Reese was named the next city manager late last month, only the third person to ever hold the job after long tenures by Peterson and his predecessor, Dave Anderson. GLT's Ryan Denham sat down with Reese to talk about walking into a tight budget year, transparency in government, and Uptown Normal's future.
Things are in the works now in terms of transitioning. He's been sharing a lot of information with me, and we've been tag-teaming in terms of attending a variety of meetings. Mark represents the town in a number of organizations, and so I've had the opportunity now to go along with him and start getting caught up on where all of his initiatives are.
And once you move into the top job, I think you start April 2nd, do you expect to hire a deputy or an assistant city manager to replace yourself at that point?
That will be eventually in the works. Right now, during this transition, I think what we'll do is use internal staff for an interim period of time until we can get settled in, determine specifically what skills and duties we want to assign to that the next assistant or deputy, and then move forward from there. So there will be a little bit of time before we actually begin recruitment.
How much time are you thinking? Because I think a lot of people will be paying attention to that search process, just because what we know from history is that the people hired into those jobs, it's a very important job, because ultimately you might become city manager one day. The Town of Normal kind of has that kind of history.
I anticipate it could be maybe 6 months or so. The reason being, we've got a number of transitions going on in our organization. And as you know, with the budget, we've eliminated some positions. Some of those positions are coming from the administrative area of the town. And so with the loss of those positions and reassigning of duties, I think we just need to make sure we are going forward in the right way, defining the job description, the duties that we need, and the skills. And so we'll use an internal staff person to help through that process.
Next year's budget is expected to be a pretty lean one for Normal. You're trying to close a $3 million projected budget deficit for the next fiscal year, 2019. You're already making plans to cut 25 staff positions, looking at some other things like cutting the Martin Luther King Jr. banquet, cutting the print newsletter the town sends out, saving a few chunks of money here and there. What are some things that Normal residents might notice have been cut, and what are some of the things you can cut that maybe won't be noticed?
Well, through this process, we're certainly going through some belt tightening, and that does force us to be a little bit more efficient and cautious, and hopefully that won't necessarily impact services at all. People won't notice that. One area that I think people could notice is the elimination of the drop box recycling program, which we intend to move forward with. That program does serve a portion of the community that currently doesn't have access to curbside recycling. So with the loss of that program, we want to make sure we can pick up the pieces elsewhere. So that will be sort of a puzzle piece kind of thing that we take to council and find solutions for. But in general, through this process, although it's very difficult to lose staff, and not a situation we'd like to be in, we do hope that the impact to the community is relatively minimal. We do have a plan to eliminate and reduce some of our grant funding. For example, the Harmon Arts Grant, we intend to drop that by 50% for the time being. In addition, the loss of the Bone Historic Preservation Grant, so that does impact some folks, certainly.
What's your approach to staff morale going to be as the new city manager? You're going to have fewer people, but probably the same amount of work or close to it. How do you absorb that without burning people out?
Well, it is. It's going to have to be something that we are cautious, that we are keeping track of. In addition, we've told the city council that there may be things that we can't continue to do because we are not staffed appropriately. I think for all intents and purposes, though, that to be able to perform our services at the level we have been, I think we're still in very good shape.
How would you describe your personal leadership style?
You know, I don't know that I can absolutely define a specific style. I would say that my style probably is dependent on the situation, honestly. And that probably goes for most folks. You can't come in and handle every situation identical. But I'd like to believe that my approach does hopefully push people to look to do things better, that every day we can be better at something, and encourage development of our staff to take on new projects, new challenges, to again think critically and analytically on how can we be better.
You got your master's degree in public administration from Western Michigan University, and then got the job here working for the town of Normal in the early 1990s. Why were you drawn to work in local government?
Actually, my undergraduate degree is in business. I was a finance major and accounting minor, and when I graduated from Western Michigan with my undergraduate degree, I went back to my hometown and went to work for an insurance company for a short period of time, and then in the financial services industry. Through that process, realized that wasn't my passion. That wasn't something I could see myself doing for about 45 years, you know, when you look ahead at a career. And was somewhat familiar with a family friend who was involved with local government, and started to understand, you know, what that role is. What does that mean? And really thought, that's something I'd like to get into. What's the best way I can do that? And determined that going back to school and getting my master's degree in public administration might be the best way. And so I went back to school full-time, got my master's degree, and then sort of the rest is history, in fact. I came down for an interview and was offered the position and have been here ever since. And part of the reason why staying with Normal, it's been an incredible opportunity that I had not anticipated back in the early 90s when I came here. But I've had an opportunity to be involved in so many different things. And in reality, the growth of Normal, not just physically in terms of expansion, but in terms of the changes that have happened in the community, have just been remarkable. And I've had an opportunity to participate in so much of that.
And you're the first woman to become a city manager in Bloomington or Normal in our long history. And we talked a little bit about this, you and I, at the announcement back in January. But can you talk a little bit more about that distinction and what you've seen in the world of local government since you joined that industry in the early 90s?
When I first started in our profession here in Normal, the group that we participate in terms of professional membership is the International City and County Management Association and the Illinois City Management Association. And early 90s, there weren't that many females that attended the meetings. There were some female city managers, village managers typically up in the metro area, but none downstate at that time. There has been growth in female leadership at the municipal government level, both city and county, and I'm just proud to be part of that group. I'm very excited.
What's your philosophy taking over this new job on transparency? That's a topic that's obviously near and dear to my heart as a member of the media, but members of the public, your typical resident, probably has some pretty strong interest in transparency as well.
I think we do certainly a respectable job at being as transparent as we can. But again, my philosophy is we can always do better. So there's probably things that we haven't done that we could do better, things that we can improve upon that we are doing. My approach which would be one of the things I think that we need to focus on is how can we best communicate? And these days, there's so many different ways to communicate with residents, and not everyone reads the newspaper these days, or not everyone listens to a local station, a TV station or such, or even participates in social media. So there's so many different approaches to communicating with residents. And so I think that will be one of the challenges, to figure out how can we best communicate, share our story, respond to inquiries and such, and do the best we can.
Normal's town council is sort of infamous for its short meetings. Maybe not as much discussion in the open as we see down the street with the Bloomington City Council. Do you think is that an indicator at all of a lack of transparency, that decisions are being made preliminarily behind closed doors, or how should we read that?
I would hope that's not the case, but certainly I could understand why someone might think that decisions might be made that way, and that would be very unfortunate because that isn't what's happening. I would like to believe that we're providing lots of great information to the City Council in advance. We provide very thorough reports, in my opinion. But again, I think if there's some concerns that we're not sharing enough information publicly, or if there's curiosity on how the City Council reached a decision, perhaps we can do better in terms of sharing that information. You know, our reports that staff prepares for the City Council are available online prior to a council meeting, and I do believe our staff does an exceptional job in gathering information and providing thorough and detailed information so the council can make adequate decisions based on the information they have. But certainly, if we need to expand upon that, we will.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Pam Reese, the incoming city manager for the town of Normal. The next stage of the Uptown Normal redevelopment appears to be the Trail East project. As you heard, I'm sure, over the last month or so, some Uptown business owners and residents have raised concerns about whether this mixed-use development will require the knocking down of three older buildings that line mm-hmm. Beaufort Street. What's the sense that you got from the council when they discussed it a few weeks ago, and what's your approach to this tension in Uptown between developments and looking to the future and also some historic preservation?
Well, certainly there's a balance. We do want to balance it, and I think Normal has done a pretty good job of that in recent years. In fact, many of the buildings that have been designated or have some sort of historic value have undergone a facade improvement and such, just to improve the building. Of course, the Normal Theater, we don't even really have to talk about that. That's exceptional. But the next project on that northeast quadrant of the circle, so to speak, you know, we'll have to talk to the developer. We haven't even met yet, but we will be talking soon about design concepts, and then we'll have to evaluate what the possibilities can be. And if council determines that the buildings at the 100 block of Beaufort should be preserved, then we'll have to see if we can work around that. At this point, no decisions have been made. The original plan for Uptown redevelopment, adopted way back in 2001, did indicate that those buildings would be gone and replaced with a newer structure. So it is the original design concept. And that's even a strong word because it hasn't even been designed yet. But in terms of the proposal and the developer's response, did comply with the plan, but no final designs have been made yet.
I think it's fair to say that Normal has a reputation for being aggressive on economic development incentives for businesses, either getting them to come here or getting existing businesses to expand in some way. In your mind, what's the right balance between enticing businesses to invest here, but not, you know, giving away the farm to get to that point?
Well, I can say there's probably no specific formula, honestly. And every project is unique and is going to have to be looked at in terms of the investment and what's the cost versus what's the benefit. Moving forward, I think much of the investment decisions that the council and the town staff are evaluating is long-term. And we say economic development, but really we're focusing on job creation and investment in our community, investment not just being public investment, but private investment. If it's creating jobs, then what? What do those individuals have? How can those individuals then who are earning their living, how will they impact the community and invest in terms of housing and such? And so it's a much broader picture with no specific formula. It just is an individual view of each project.
But in that formula, jobs is sort of paramount, it sounds like?
Absolutely. I think jobs and just keeping people in terms of you want to have people here, present. And, you know, with that comes the investment. The investment in wanting to be here, the investment in earning an income and raising a family, perhaps, investing in cultural arts. And so I think it's all much part of a bigger picture.
The relationship between Bloomington and Normal took a bit of a hit last year with the Metro Zone dispute. This is over a tax sharing agreement that Bloomington wanted to exit. That cost Normal some money. So I want to ask, how much of a priority is it for you to improve and build upon that relationship between the town and the city of Bloomington?
It has to be a high priority, honestly. You know, we can't, in terms of economic development or almost any initiative, you can't look at boundaries.
What do you think of a shared sales tax between the city of Bloomington and the town of Normal? It's something that's been kicked around as a possible way to mitigate poaching retailers from one community to the other, being mm-hmm. one example. But what do you think of that idea generally?
I think it's certainly something that should be discussed if possible. I think Normal's open to this discussion. I would hope Bloomington would be open to the discussion. You know, it's hard to make a decision when you haven't had a dialogue about it. So I think that it does, that concept is worth greater discussion.
All right, so this is, since this is kind of a getting to know you thing for our listeners who want to hear from the new city manager, Normal, I'm going to end this discussion with a rapid fire round. Quick answers, quick questions. Favorite local restaurant?
Oh my goodness, there's so many. I'm going to have to say Distill.
Favorite character on NBC's Parks and Recreation, which is sort of the seminal television program about local government work?
Oh my goodness. I've watched it, but I can't remember names, so.
Favorite local restaurant or watering hole that is no longer around, but that you liked maybe when you first got to town?
Well, I really liked Rocky's Hamburgers.
Where was that?
Well, Rocky's was pretty much the site where Children's Discovery Museum is right now. I used to go down there for burgers and fries for lunch occasionally.
What is your favorite thing about Bloomington that you're kind of sort of jealous about that they have that Normal doesn't?
Well, I really like, we're big fans of the Pepsi Ice Center.
Okay, this is GLT, so I'm like legally obligated to ask, do you own a bike and do you like to ride bikes?
I do own I own two bikes, and yes, I like to ride bikes.
You've got a Saturday off. It's midsummer. You've got the whole day free to do whatever the heck you want. How do you spend it?
I probably start the day with a walk with the dog, spend a little time at the pool if it's a nice, sunny, warm day, and then probably meet my husband for some dinner.
Dave Anderson got a park and aquatic center named after him when he retired. What do you want to name after Mark Peterson?
That would be super secret. Can't share with that. No, actually, I don't know. But that's a decision up to the city council.
That's Pam Reese, the incoming city manager for the town of Normal. She starts the job April 2nd. I'm Ryan Denham.
Reese was chosen for the job after a nationwide search that resulted in 49 applicants. The town paid a recruitment firm $20,000 to help with that search that ultimately led to Reese, already the town's number two administrator. Mark Peterson's last day is Friday, March 30th. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, find out how three entrepreneurs are faring selling analog music in the digital age, John Norton reports during Sound Ideas here on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. Recent trends show a slight uptick in vaccine-preventable diseases. Researchers have developed the protections, but not all parents are taking advantage. IPR's Jacqueline Driscoll looks in today's ongoing vaccine debate.
Behind closed doors in Dr. Doug Carlson's office, parents are able to privately discuss and make decisions for their children.
I'm sorry, what is his name?
Caden.
How old are you, Caden?
Four.
Feel like in your mouth?
One of the more prevalent debates in recent years deals with vaccines. Health professionals like Carlson champion the effectiveness and necessity of getting kids vaccinated.
There is science. Okay, science is included in my biases.
For decades, vaccines have helped eradicate deadly and debilitating diseases. Currently, roughly 40 immunizations are required to protect against 12 types of diseases for children 12 and under. Despite the evidence showing vaccines are safe, there is a disconnect in communication between the medical community and some parents. Take, for example, Stephanie Google, a mother of twins.
A lot of people just get manipulated into these vaccines. I know people trust your doctor, and to some degree you have to.
Google isn't the only parent with concerns.
Research before you make a decision for your children.
When you get a vaccine, they get paid. And then the more vaccines you get, they get bonuses from the vaccine companies.
It makes me wonder if we're doing more harm than good.
While these certainly aren't the only arguments against vaccines, these do seem to be the loudest. And Dr. Carlson seems to have an answer for them all, too.
What do you say to parents who don't think there's enough research regarding vaccines or the vaccination schedule?
All of these that are well-researched. The idea that they're under-researched is just not true.
I have to ask, do you get a bonus every time you give a vaccination?
Our practice actually breaks even on their vaccinations, so there is no profit motive.
What about parents concerned with an increase in the number of vaccines administered?
I say thank goodness that we live in the 21st century, that we have the vaccines to prevent diseases of which children used to die from or get serious illness from.
Camille Saraf, a mother of four, supports vaccinations.
So I have four sons. They're all fully vaccinated. And in fact, three of them I was very specific to take back and have revaccinated against the measles because their oldest brother was diagnosed with leukemia 3 years ago.
Her son Joseph is considered immunocompromised, and he still has a risk of severe reactions to something as simple as the common cold. Still, those parents wary of vaccines are worried their children will be harmed. Saraf, who is also a physician at HSHS St. John's Hospital in Springfield, says she understands the concern, and she chalks it up to a misunderstanding.
They do it because they have been convinced there is something to fear from that shot. There isn't. Okay, we're fearing the wrong thing. What we need to fear is the disease.
Dr. Craig Batterman, the associate professor of pediatrics at SIU School of Medicine, says this misunderstanding comes with serious risks.
If we allow this trend to continue of more and more people opting out of vaccines, you're going to see more and more epidemics. In the end, there's going to be it's not just going to be people that are getting sick. There's going to be people that are going to die from this.
But not every disease is viewed the same. It wasn't long ago that kids getting the chicken pox, measles, and mumps was more like a rite of passage. That's despite some cases that proved to be severe. Now children can be immunized against them, adding to the growing number of vaccines given. The state of Illinois has tried to walk a fine line by requiring vaccinations, but at the same time allowing exemptions and a delayed schedule to get those shots. Science may be on the side of the medical community with Dr. Saraf, but she says physicians need to be educators as well.
We have successfully eradicated not the disease, but everybody's memory of the disease.
I'm Jacqueline Driscoll.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. It's Sound Ideas on GLT. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Wind can snatch your hat, mess your hair, and power up a community. It can also be a friend or a foe in the garden. In this edition of GLT's Grow, Patrick Murphy has an appreciation for the wind.
Water, soil, and sun all impact our plants, but so does the wind. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field. From the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
We meet again. Hi, Laura.
Hello. Today on GLT's Grow, how wind can impact our plants. Well, I know for a fact how it affected. I had a Bradford pear in the front yard, and that doggone thing knocked it down. So it can have a bad effect, but it can do good things too, right?
It for sure can. Besides making your hair look great, wind is a shaping force in the landscape. And I always like to refer to art, and one art form that has some predictability when it comes to wind is the art of bonsai. Mm-hmm. And maymay, its miniature counterpart. Many of the forms in bonsai and maymay are based on the windswept shape of a tree, whether it's cascading or just kind of leaning to the left or the right. Mm-hmm. And when you see artwork that conveys wind, you get the sense or the sensation of movement in that image, and I just think that that's worth bringing up.
It's cool.
Because there's good and bad things when it comes to wind, but fortunately, I think there's more good than bad.
Let's talk about the good, shall we?
So wind shapes plants, particularly trees and woody plants. They're shaped by the wind because, like we said, they could be windswept, you know, so if it's the only plant in an open area.
Right.
Its form will follow the prevailing wind, and it'll kind of be heavier on one side away from the wind.
Huh.
So the side of the tree that faces the wind is takes more of the brunt of that cold weather exposure, or just prolonged periods of wind in arid climates or subtropical climates has an impact too. The bark could be thicker on that side of the tree to protect it from the wind and the sun. They kind of go hand in hand, especially when you start getting up off the ground, up where the tree canopies are at. But the leaning of trees and woody plants is affected by the wind or their response to wind that has been buffered by other plants or buildings. That asymmetrical presentation of plants adds character. It's oftentimes a benefit. It's different from seeing a tree that's just crooked because of the way it was planted. I'm not talking about that. I don't particularly find that desirable.
No.
But a plant that is altered, particularly trees, you can see sometimes that the crown of the tree is not round like we drew them in elementary school. It's more football shaped, where it's thick in the center and kind of pointed on the ends. That's because the tree is very much keyed into what is the wind it's dealing with. And then the plant follows the path of least resistance, and that gives us these off-centered crowns and shrubs that are not perfectly in line with where they emerge from the ground.
Uh-huh.
And it can even have an impact on the general presentation. So like I said, sometimes it's really obvious that the tree is fighting the wind. Here on campus, there is a large sycamore.
Where on campus?
It's where the old Atkin Colby dormitories were, and mm-hmm. that site is being reconquered, repurposed by the university. But this tree was saved, fortunately. And for years, the tree was leaning away from these kind of high-rise dormitories that are now part of the past.
Yes.
But it leaned away from them to seek the sun, right? Because it was growing away from the shade. Well, now those buildings are gone, and the wind is full force there because they were protecting that tree. And sycamores are trashy trees already, but this one you can tell the wind is knocking all the weak stuff out of it because
wow.
the ground is just covered with all these broken branches.
Amazing.
But the wind can also damage plants, and it can do so through the weight that's added to the plant in the form of rain, snow, or ice, right? So the weight's added, and then the combination of the wind, and bang, you have a damaged plant. But it can also damage plants by either tearing or breaking the leaves, or in certain cases, Japanese maples, for example, they get a little leaf spot on them, and that's a little diseased spot on the leaf. The leaf is weak there, and then the wind blows a hole through that little diseased spot on the leaf. And so that's where the wind's making a bad situation worse.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, the wonders of the wind. You know, I've always wondered myself if when you're putting a new tree in the ground and the nurserymen put that in there and then they stake it. And so I've always thought, well, I know they're staking it to help it, you know, maybe withstand the wind, but wouldn't the wind help it a bit to, at least a bit, to help strengthen the roots in the ground?
It helps it a bunch.
Okay.
Actually, and the timing of the stakes is important.
All right.
And the judgment to put the stakes on is important, too, because there are cases where you just don't need them. And I think that those are obvious cases when there's protection from other things. But the stakes that are on too long or they're on in an incorrect manner, they're removing the benefit of having the basal part of the trunk. That's where it emerges from the ground, that elephant foot flare, if you will.
Yes.
That develops a stronger basal flare when wind is part of the daily equation, particularly during the growing season. And when you see the trunk flares, so if you see a whole group of trees, but the ones that are closest to the source of the wind, their flares will be the most dramatic.
Huh.
Because they've built up muscles of sorts, not real muscles, but they have extra layers of cells, and there's been extra growth in that part of the woody area of the tree over time. And it's developed this elephant's foot or this flare that is asymmetrical. It's strong where it faces the wind with gently sweeping arches or deep sweeping arches away from the wind where it's not as important. You get things that are closer to a 90 degree angle
mm-hmm.
or something a few degrees off from that. So the wind is a plus in that case, right? Because the tree is not developing the strength to deal with the environment that it's in. And because the stakes were left on too long, in that case, when the stakes come off, you could incur some damage because you've developed kind of a weak tree.
That's a very, very good point. Yes.
So, but the wind also spreads pollen. You know, that's a necessary part of the flowering and reproduction of plants and the creation of seeds. But that same wind can even spread diseases and at the same time can prevent them. So we have fire blight here in the Midwest and attacks, the rose family of plants. You know, we talk about flowering pears, crab apples. They get a disease called fire blight often in the spring from cool, wet conditions. Well, cool and wet combined with lots of wind will lead to less wet. So cool and dry with less moisture, that will prevent the spread or outbreak of fire blight. So that's where the wind is kind of a surprise, unexpected in the spring, could help dry things out between those spring rains enough that the conditions for the development of fire blight never occur. They never occur. But at the same time, right, we got to think about the plants down close to the ground. If the wind is so strong that it's drying up that water in the soil near the surface
right.
faster than the plants can take it up, now we have a situation where the wind is one step back again.
Wind, you gotta love it and you gotta hate it because it can help and it can hurt.
It's great. Like I said, it makes your hair look fantastic and it can blow your leaves into your neighbor's yard and that ain't bad either.
That is true. Okay, Murph, thanks so much. Next week on GLT's Grow, we've got a question from Dennis in Bloomington about milky spore. Can it work against Japanese beetles? Well, we'll find out. If you've got a gardening question, we'd like to hear from you. Send it along to us and maybe Murph will answer it on the air. That's WGLT.org/grow.
You can download the Grow podcast weekly at iTunes or WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. NPR One is ready when you want to listen.
I get lots of great content every day. It's replaced my other podcast.
Hear stories and interviews picked just for you. Catch up on NPR and GLT News.
Just kind of let it play through, and it picks up national stuff, local stuff. It just mixes it all in.
It's public radio made personal.
I'm Jason McIntyre from Bloomington, and I listen to NPR One.
NPR One is at the Apple App Store and Google Play. Learn more at WGLT.org/NPR1.
Support for GLT comes from DoubleTree by Hilton, a full-service wedding venue for any size reception or intimate courtyard ceremony. Their professional team attends to all your dreams as you create a memorable celebration. Bridal suite and overnight group rates available. Ashley has the details at 309-661-7583. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. In 2016, streaming services became the primary way Americans listen to music. But Bloomington Normal still has three independent record stores where physical music, mostly vinyl, makes up nearly all of their sales. Indeed, record stores in the Twin Cities have bucked the current rising in popularity from a low point about 15 years ago. GLT's John Norton digs into three entrepreneurs who sell analog in a digital space.
John Anderson remembers he was 13 years old when he first walked into Mother Murphy's and then Downtown Normal in the 1980s.
I mean, it was like this scary, kind of heady experience. There's incense and there's records and there's loud music and naked ladies and posters and just like, you know, it was a very visceral experience and I'll never forget that.
It was a long 21 steps up that narrow stairwell of the iconic store that's been on North Street since the late 1960s. When Anderson and others reached the top step back in the day, it was often owner Mike Williams who offered a greeting. He still does.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Man, that's a long walk up those stairs.
I've been doing it for nearly 40 years. Keeps me young.
Though Mother Murphy's still sells a few albums, the store's focus has changed in recent years.
A head shop, a hippie shop, a gift store, sure. Skateboard shop with Shockwaves, sure.
And even some albums still.
Yes, we do still have some records.
And he remembers when John Anderson was a music-obsessed teenager.
Oh, I'd see him several times a week, you know, and he would always be going through the bins and grabbing up the records that he most wanted. But, yeah, he was definitely one of my best customers. Got to spill on
it. John Anderson still buys stacks of vinyl, but now he resells them as the owner of Reverberation Vinyl on Main Street across from Illinois Wesleyan in Bloomington. It's the newest of the Twin Cities' three record stores. He opened shop in March of 2011. That was 7 years after the birth of North Street Records and Waiting Room Records on North Street and Uptown. Anderson says the idea to start his own record store had been simmering since the late 1990s. That's when friends were reminding him of his immense record collection and his encyclopedic knowledge of music.
At the time, it was they're kind of like, man, you should just open a shop. Like, I was just all about records all the time, and, you know, I was constantly buying and piling up stuff, and so it didn't take much of a push to kind of think, like, okay, well, yeah, I could do this.
Anderson's store sells 100% vinyl, about 65% used. But it's his new music inventory that gets his mojo working and where his business philosophy becomes unorthodox. Anderson loves and thinks you should love psychedelic and underground rock.
I very clearly chose to be that kind of store when I opened up, where it's I want to bring people along to what I think is good. Like a store should be a tastemaker on some level, where you're trying to bring people along, get them into new things, rather than just feeding people what they want.
He also thinks you should like free jazz, folk, and international music. He'll tell you it's music you need.
If you want the Beatles, go look in the B section. If you want to find out what kind of store this is and what I think you should have, go look at the stuff on the wall, look at the stuff on the racks. Music that I like, that I love, I think other people should love, that I'm passionate about. And that's what I want to sell people.
It's not what they teach in business school, but you seem to be getting away with it.
Yet here I am.
Mike Williams of Mother Murphy's also has a deep history with North Street Records owner Jeff Wilson. It began in 1985 when Mother Murphy's was more of a head shop with just a few crates of records. Wilson was perusing the record bins on a day an employee quit.
You know, they started giving me a quiz once I got hired there. They gave me a quiz on music, and I answered them all, and then I started asking them questions, and I said, okay, you're hired.
He was my buyer.
That's Mike Williams.
We started out as strictly used, and then we worked our way into some niche categories, you know, the punk rock and different categories that some of the other record chain stores might not handle, all that kind of smaller label things.
At the time, Wilson was deep into 60s garage rock and their 80s imitators.
So I started carrying some of those records. You know, it's like one of those things where I really wanted to push these records onto people because I thought they were so great. I was like, well, you guys really need to hear this. Check this out. And created a big fan base, and a lot of people used to come in there just to buy brand new releases on certain labels.
Wilson worked at Mother Murphy's for nearly two decades and thought he might eventually even buy the store. But Mike Williams understandably didn't want to sell what Wilson still calls a gold mine, so he opened his own nearby storefront in 2004.
And I really wanted to call it Kick Out the Jams, like the MC5, or I wanted to call it Let It Rock after Chuck Berry. My business partners and I voted, and we thought North Street Records was the obvious thing.
All right.
You know, I don't know. I know I don't spend a lot of money here, but you guys have no idea how much joy I get buying these old records for $1.
That's awesome.
I love it.
It's Saturday morning in early February at North Street Records. That man is buying a stack of albums he probably grew up listening to. The 60s and 70s classic rock the store is known for. Nearly 80% of North Street sales is vinyl.
$4, $9, $12.
And if you want to know about those bands, John Anderson of Reverberation Vinyl says Jeff Wilson is your guy.
I mean, listen, I loved the Beatles when I was a kid, and like we happened to have one of the biggest Beatle experts in the country living in this town. Like Jeff Wilson knows more about the Beatles than maybe more than, you know, 10 other people in the country know what he knows. Like the guy is a font of knowledge when it comes to that stuff.
Man, I'm just a fanatic. It makes me appear like an expert, but you know, I know some guys out there that are a little bit heavier in it to me, but I'm more into collecting the vinyl, collecting in foreign pressings and just bizarre versions of songs, outtakes and bootlegs and anything that's kind of weird or different. I like to get those.
The third independent record store in town is one storefront east of North Street Records. Jared Elkhorn opened Waiting Room Records barely a few weeks before Wilson opened in 2004. Elkhorn's bread and butter? New music, especially indie rock.
Punk does really good. Metal doing a lot better, but it also depends on the year because it's a college town. Things always change. A couple years ago, we did really, really good with jazz, and we also do really well with experimental and industrial music.
And not surprisingly, in this tight-knit record community, Elkhorn also has a history with Mother Murphy's. It's when Jeff Wilson ran the record side.
I grew up shopping at Mother Murphy's when I was a punk rock teenager, and Jeff helped put a bunch of great bands in my mind and in my hands. And, you know, he was always very helpful to us as kids.
Elkhorn even worked for Wilson one summer.
I spent a lot of time that summer kind of tidying up the store and pulling out old stock, you know, finding stuff that was in the store that was like hidden gems. And I was like, hey, you know, here's a bunch of stuff. And I would try to work as close as I could with Jeff to help get some of that cool stuff out on the floor. And I think as a team, we did pretty good.
That summer was between stints working for Deadpan Alley Records, located at what was then the corner of North and Buford after a move from the old Apple Tree Records location. Elkhorn started as a 17-year-old, and when Deadpan closed shop 7 years later, he bought the few crates of records not liquidated, and
he sold me the fixtures. All the fixtures in the store belonged to Deadpan Alley.
All the racks?
All the racks, yeah. And I think part of it belonged also to Apple Tree Records, so that's just been handed me down.
Elkhorn has now owned his store, named for a Fugazi song, for 14 years, twice as long as his tenure at Deadpan Alley. Working there is where he formulated the vibe he wanted for his own record store one day.
I've always said that I like my store to run like a Cheers-like environment, so I try to learn everyone's name if I can. If you're in here once a week, I definitely know your name. If you're in here once every other couple of weeks, I probably know who you are or I know what you've been buying.
He's like a human search algorithm, not unlike digital algorithms Pandora and Spotify pay software developers to create.
It might not be something that I'm personally interested in, but I'd like to have a fun conversation about music, and I might listen to something and be like, oh, you know what? Elliot might really like this.
That's partially why I go in there. Like, they could be friendly faces and everything, but it's also awesome to get into in-depth discussions and kind of have an opinion.
That's Elliot Lusk. He's a junior biology major at ISU and a graduate of Bloomington High School. He was in Waiting Room Records shopping for new sounds on this afternoon. Lusk said he also shops at North Street Records and Reverberation Vinyl and appreciates when store owners get to know his tendencies.
It's definitely shaped my own musical tastes, and each of them have definitely shown me something, either that or know that I've liked something and like held it aside for me, and they're like, oh, here, check this out, and I've dug everything that they've shown me.
There is a buzz happening that, like the local music scene in general, Bloomington Normal is viewed by many as the place for records in Central Illinois. John Huff is a graphic designer in his late 30s who lives in Champaign-Urbana.
One of the first things we do when we're traveling is, you know, hit up the local record stores and see what's in there. And I mean, having three shops in a town this size is great.
Shopping with friends in late January in Reverberation Vinyl, Huff said feasting on three stores in one stop is a bonus, but ultimately it's what's in the bins.
I'm really impressed with lesser known genres like electronic music or just the kind of like the quirkier stuff. Like a lot of record shops, you'll go too, is just like a ton of rock, pop, kind of the same stuff that everybody has. And then those sections tend to be very small. But here they have like a really robust, some unique stuff in here, which is always great to see.
It's also music not generally stocked in chain stores or easy to find online.
What I did miss the most, like when I was just doing digital, was like being able to go in the store and get those recommendations from somebody who worked there. When you're online, it's just like, here's everything ever. You know, there's like no real curating of it.
The Twin Cities has roughly 1.5 more record stores than Peoria, though Peoria has a metro nearly 2.5 times larger. Springfield has 2 stores, ditto Champaign-Urbana, well, 2.1, although CU has a university footprint nearly twice the size of ISU. That's where Veronica Glatt is a senior in fashion design. She believes ISU is at least partially responsible for the success of the local record store scene.
So we have lots of people that come from different places who might not necessarily have record stores, like a lot of people from like the surrounding smaller towns in this area.
Glatt has been hanging out in Twin Cities record stores long enough that she now works part-time for North Street Records. She thinks the thriving record store scene is also related to the vibrant broader music scene with multiple music venues.
We have like bigger bands will come to the Coliseum, and then we have the Castle, and then we have like Meltdown Creative Works, and like I know people who still have like house shows even in this town and stuff. So the local music scene is pretty strong, so it makes sense that there are record stores to back up the musical interest in this town.
And those local musicians riff off the stores. Aaron Dooley is with the Bloomington-based psychedelic rock band Gay Neighbors.
There's been so many records I've just taken a chance on. Maybe it looks cool or the description of it's interesting, and that inspires you to start pushing in new musical directions. If the bands that are playing in town are inspired by that stuff, the people that enjoy listening to the local bands will then be like, oh, what are your influences? That just starts generating more bin dig.
That bin digging in the digital age runs the age spectrum. But as they have since the vinyl boom began a decade ago, college students like Elliot Lusk are driving the market.
I guess it kind of seems more real and upfront, and it's also kind of the convenience factor. When I'm here and I want something, and I can just go ahead and listen to it and have it right there, right then. Whereas online, it would be having to wait the 3 to 5 days shipping.
But there's also something else about a record store Spotify, iTunes, and Amazon can't replicate.
I feel like it gives me kind of an excuse of things to do. It's the modern day drugstore, you know, hanging outside, as well as shop around and meet friends and hang out.
Sidney Machillin Cavanaugh is one of those friends he was hanging out with on this afternoon at Waiting Room Records.
I'm not into quite as frequently as Elliot is, but I would say the main reason I'm going to record stores is the social aspects.
Machillin Cavanaugh is a Heartland Community College student.
A lot of times if I don't have anything going on in a Saturday afternoon, me and my friends are walking around downtown, we'll just come in and browse for like half hour, 45 minutes, and so it's nice to kind of see what they're interested in, see what I'm interested in. It's just kind of a nice way to spend a day.
Record stores as a social hub, that's not new. But it's interesting that in the digital age, when chains like Best Buy are ditching CDs and soon vinyl, so many, especially younger people, still crave human contact and camaraderie with their music. Jared Elkhorn at Waiting Room Records cultivates it.
I don't know how many people come in the door and they'll say something like, well, your competitor sent me down to you. And I'm like, yeah, and I'll send you right back to them. Like, that's having two stores, that, especially us being so close together, it's why battle about it? Like, we can thrive together if we work together.
It's an interesting comment in a dog-eat-dog capitalistic society. You'd think Jared Elkhorn, Jeff Wilson, and John Anderson would be eyeing each other warily in spite of their 3 decades of shared history. But like Elkhorn, Wilson doesn't see it that way.
Those guys are both my friends, too. You know, I've been in the business a lot longer than both of them, so they were all really good customers of mine. So we're all really good friends and stuff, so the last thing I'd want to do is piss them off.
And John Anderson of Reverberation Vinyl thinks it would be a, quote, bunk move to try to poach customers from stores owned by guys he's known and liked since he was a teen. For him, it's not about market share. It's about mission.
If I'm going to do this, if I'm going to make this my life's work and spend every day, you know, and every night, I'm going to do it pushing the music that I like and that I want to get people into. If you're looking for reasons why I did this, my whole attitude toward it, like freedom's a big piece of it.
Jeff Wilson says at North Street Records, he's busier than ever.
I remember when I worked at Mother Murphy's back in the 80s, we'd play checkers in the summertime because it was so dead out here. I'd get laid off for a month because there was nothing to do in the summer. Nowadays it's so busy that I barely even know when the semesters end because there's so many people in town.
And John Anderson doesn't see this trend going away anytime soon as kids are again growing up in houses with record players and people of all ages continue to buy vinyl. For WGLT, I'm John Norton.
Other stores selling vinyl in the Twin Cities include Bobsey Bay in downtown Bloomington and pawn shops including Midwest Exchange, Monster Pawn, and McLean County Exchange. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. You're listening to Sound Ideas and the Beatles. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal with stories and interviews today from Ryan Denham, John Norton, and Laura Kennedy. Find the full show podcast and individual stories and interviews at WGLT.org. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. You can even call and leave a message about Sound Ideas at 309-438-WGLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.